We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers.
I'm Ronnie Allen, not Alex Trebek. But just for fun, imagine that you're a contestant on the TV show Jeopardy! And I'm the host. The category for Final Jeopardy is pop music hits of the 70s. And here's the clue. The title of this top 15 national hit song from 1972 contains the word don't twice. Good luck. Okay, dear contestant, since this is a Ronnie Remembers version of Jeopardy, please announce your answer, and be sure it's in the form of a question.
What is?
Don't say you don't remember.
You're right! Well, I don't know if it's the only hit song with the word don't appearing twice in the title, but I do know that today's guest is the incredibly talented singer, songwriter, and actress who recorded that hit song from 1972. She has starred in numerous theatrical productions, notably Hair and The Me Nobody Knows on Broadway, and several others. And she's performed in clubs and concerts all over the country, and has also appeared in TV commercials and movies, as well as on talk and entertainment shows such as The Tonight Show, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, and American Bandstand. And she did something really big for Disney. And speaking of really big, how about a really big drum roll for Beverly Bremers? Beverly, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Ronnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is really special to me because back in 1972, I started my employment with Casey Kasem. I was the East Coast researcher for American Top 40, and one of the first people that I interviewed by phone was you. Because you had released Don't Say You Don't Remember. Later, it was late in 1971, and this was early in 1972, and it was climbing the chart. And I was the one that told Casey that your name is not pronounced Beverly Bremers.
you're the one. Okay.
When I first spoke to you, I said, is Beverly Bremers there? And you said, well, actually, it's Beverly Bremers. And I said, I better tell Casey. So I did, and he pronounced it right from then on. So it rhymes with Dreamers.
Yes, that's what I always tell people. Yeah, and of course, he passed it along to Dick Clark.
Was Dick doing it wrong, too?
I think everybody was.
Oh, probably.
I don't think there's anyone, for some reason. It's always been that way in my family. Everybody with that last name, for some reason, people think of it as having two M's, and so they say Bremers.
And you have an amazing career, and Don't Say You Don't Remember is actually one of the most remembered songs. I mean, it's 45 years later, and everybody still remembers that song. They've forgotten a lot of other songs that were on the chart. But for some reason, Don't Say You Don't Remember is one that kind of struck a nerve, and people still remember that song.
And what is amazing to me is that everybody has a story to go with it.
Wow.
So when people email me or they post something on my YouTube page, they all remember what they were doing and who they were with. And it's really interesting that the song has significance for them. Just one of those songs.
You were born in Chicago, I believe.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You only stayed there for about maybe a little bit under 3 years, and then you moved with your family to St. Louis.
That's correct, yes. And so I spent my younger years there until I was 10.
And those younger years included studying acting.
I was 8. I took classes, and then I was in several productions. I was also on a TV show there. My mother was a writer, and so she worked me into being on one of her TV shows at a young age, too. So, you know, I had a little bit of that background. And then when we moved to the suburbs of New York, I didn't really mess around too much with singing until I was 12. I thought I was a brilliant comedian.
Oh, really?
Yes. I had written and directed a play. I entered the Kiwanis Club talent show with this comedy sketch with a couple of people, which I thought was hysterical. So my friend, who I thought was a very talented dancer, was a little shy, and I really wanted her to be in the talent show. Mm-hmm. So basically she and her brother dared me to do something myself, because they said, oh, the skit doesn't count because you have other people.
Uh-huh.
Do something by yourself. I pretty much, my motivation for singing in the talent show was so she would dance in the talent show. So I sang the only song that I knew, which was Hey, Look Me Over. And, you know, I just came out and belted it out. And much to my shock, and my parents, I think, too, I won.
Wow.
I was standing there trying to figure out who was going to win. They called my name. I didn't even hear it. You know, someone pushed me. So it was at that moment that my parents realized that I had singing talent. They hadn't really thought about it. So then I went on to an all-county talent show, and Ted Mack was there. He lived in the area, or his scout was, I guess. And so they asked me to be on Ted Mack Amateur Hour. Wow. So on my 13th birthday, I was on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. And that pretty much got me going.
Can I ask what you sang on the show?
Oh, I still sang Hey, Look Me Over.
I bet you Lucille Ball would have been very proud. That was the best-known song from her musical, Wildcat.
Wildcat, that's right, yeah.
Yes.
So
da.
I didn't realize it at the time, but I liked it because it was a big belty song, and I didn't even realize what a big voice I had.
Wow.
But I did, and so everyone was, like, stunned. So after that, living in Westchester County, which was like a suburb of New York, there were a lot of people around that were in the business. And so I started getting offers, singing here and there. I started singing at Palisades Amusement Park in New Jersey. Oh, and I performed with some great recording artists and met all these top DJs.
Wow.
And I was singing to other people's records, which was hilarious. I think of it now, and I was like, oh, my God, was that nervy or what? Like Leslie Gore records, I would just sing over her records. So from that, I was offered a recording contract. This guy thought I really had potential, and he was a writer, producer. And so I made my first record when I was 14.
Pickwick Records?
Pickwick Records, yes. They called it the Showcase label.
Showcase.
But it was distributed by Pickwick International.
And you were Beverly Ann, without the Bremers.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to have a copy of Both Sides.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah. One of them has something to do with Trouble.
Yes, it does. Yes.
And it has kind of a Gene Pitney type of a feel.
Well, I would describe the lyrics that way. The lyrics always reminded me of Town Without Pity, about everybody in town being against, well, in this case, me and my boyfriend. So we got trouble.
like that.
Well, thank you.
And the flip side is an interesting choice, The Great Pretender, the old Platters hit.
Yes. My producer, Terry Phillips, always loved that song. I, of course, was too young. I was 14 when I recorded it. I was too young to know the song. But he said, hey, let's do it. Let's give it a little bit of a beat. It should still work. You know, I was a rock and roll singer, so that's what we did. Gave it a beat.
I'm lonely, but no one can tell. Yeah, I'm the great pretender.
Beverly, you rocked back then.
I was a rock and roll singer, pretty much. Yeah, I don't think I sounded all that different, actually.
Right.
Well, I went on to RCA and had several records with them, and that's when I started appearing all over the country. I would go off on weekends with my father, and I would do these local American Bandstand-type shows. So I did quite a few.
Before you became an overnight success, quote-unquote, with Don't Say You Don't Remember, you were all over the country.
Yeah, I was.
Even without a hit record at that time, people were starting to know who you were. How did you get involved with the musical Hair?
Well, basically, I auditioned. I was originally going to audition for it when it was off Broadway. We thought it was kind of a crazy name for a show. And
it was.
So I never went. This is kind of unusual. I did in-store shows, like little mini shows in the junior dress department. For Clairol, they had come out with some products other than the hair coloring. They had like a hair setter and cosmetics, and they had all these things. And they got this brilliant idea to do live shows in the department stores, which I thought was really cool. And I did a bunch of them with another guy named Lamont Washington, who had been Sammy Davis Jr.'s understudy in Golden Boy. And so Lamont and I became really good friends, and he got into the original cast of Hair. And I was all set to go see him in the show when he died in a horrible fire. He fell asleep smoking. I don't know. That's all they could figure out. It was just horrible. So I didn't go see the show, and, you know, obviously I had no desire. It was a horrible thing that happened to him. He was extremely talented and really a great guy. So then cut to, I was at the commuter train one day, and a couple that I knew got off the train and said, "Oh, Beverly, we just saw the most fabulous show and thought of you. You are perfect for it."
Uh-huh.
And I went, "Oh, really? Okay, maybe I should see it." So enough time had passed.
Uh-huh.
So I went to a matinee, and I sat there going, "Oh, this is perfect for me."
Uh-huh.
So I called an agent who I had met. He was with one of the big agencies, and he had said to me, the old agent thing, "Hey, sweetheart, here's my card. Call me if you ever need help." So I called him, and I said, "Did you mean what you said?" And he said, "Yeah, what do you need?" I said, "Well, I want to set up an audition for hair. I don't want to go to a cattle call, lost in the shuffle.
Right.
Could you give me an appointment?" And he goes, "Nobody ever gets in that show." And he had represented Lynn Kellogg, who was the original in the show. And I go, "I've seen it. I really think that I'm right for it." So he set it up. I went into the audition. I sang. And they said, "Which company would you like to be in? You want to be in New York or you want to open the show in L.A.?" And I was like, "What?" I had just graduated from high school, wanted to be on Broadway, and, you know, I was living with my parents. I didn't know anybody in L.A., so I said, "Oh, I want to be, you know, in the Broadway company." Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. That's how I started, like, the next week.
What part did you play in the show?
Well, initially, I played many roles. Pretty much, they had me play Chrissy a lot. I sang the song Frank Mills. I was the youngest-looking one there and the smallest, and Shelley Plimpton, if you ever saw her, is teeny tiny. I wanted to play Sheila, and they kept saying I was too young, too young. So I did that for a while, and then I auditioned for another show that I really wanted to be in and worked very hard to get into, and it was a show called The Me Nobody Knows. And basically, they thought they needed an all-black cast, and I convinced them that there are blondes in the ghetto. It was about poor people.
Was this on
Broadway? I said, "There are blondes in the ghetto."
Was this a Broadway show?
Started off Broadway.
Okay.
Started at the Orpheum in the East Village,
okay. And
it was a smash hit. No bad reviews.
And you were in it.
Loved it.
You were in it.
And I was in it. We developed it. It was based on the writings of kids in the ghetto. They don't call it the ghetto anymore. Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York. And it was a teacher who had said to the kids, "You know, just write what you feel. Forget about grammar and structure and all that. We just want to hear your thoughts and your feelings." And he put out a book that was a collection of these writings. And these writers saw it and said, "My God, this would make a great show." They basically took the writings, and the 12 of us kids, the age ranges started at 11 years old, one of whom was Irene Cara, who you know from records. This was already her second Broadway show. She was
a
very experienced performer. So we developed the structure of the show and named our characters, and we really put the show together. It was a wonderful experience. And then there was a strike off Broadway for the whole thing, and so the producers decided, "Hey, we're a hit, let's go to Broadway." So then we went to Broadway.
The CD, The Me Nobody Knows, you're on that CD. That is still available on Amazon. I know that. I saw it there.
It's on Amazon. Also, there's a Me Nobody Knows, I think it's a website or a Facebook page where you can also purchase it directly from the music writer.
I'd like to play excerpts from a couple of the tracks which you're involved in. The first one I want to play is How I Feel.
The character that I played, Catherine, was kind of a depressed soul, and she just let her heart pour out how she felt. Not quite suicidal, but close to it. And then her boyfriend later joins in, so it becomes a duet at the end. But the whole beginning is my big sad story, how I feel.
Hard to tell you how I feel. Everything is so unreal. Lord, this life is a hard thing to get to. Saw my shadow on the wall. Saw my love nowhere at all. Saw my life as a hard thing to get through. When you're born, they carry you. When you're gone, they bury you. In between, you're on your own. Hard to stand there all alone. Someone's crying down the hall. Dying cries, they tell it all. Lord, this life is a hard thing to live, and harder still to leave.
When you're born, they carry you. When you're gone,
did the duet part at the end?
A wonderful guy named Jose Fernandez.
I'm going to play one more now from that CD. Kind of an unusual song. It's called Sounds. That is a duet, right from the very start?
Yes. I did the song with a wonderful actress named Hattie Winston. She was on a TV show recently called Becker. She was on Sesame Street later on. This song was written 6 days before we opened. It had very complex rhymes, and so she and I were like one when we sang it. We were riveted. It was a really intense song, and we enjoyed doing it every night, and we reprised it later in the show, too.
Clapping.
That was Sounds. Very nice recording, Beverly.
Thanks, Ronnie.
And I understand that someone else, quite famous, also at some point in her career, played the role of Catherine.
Donna Summer played that role in another company. Our paths crossed a few times because she was really good friends with Paul Jabara, who was in the original cast of Hair. And he did Hair in Germany with her. She was in Hair also, but in Germany. And they stayed friends, and so I stayed friends with him too. Wonderful songwriter. And he locked her in a bathroom one day and played a song that he'd written for her, which was Last Dance.
Oh, gee. We know the rest
of that. Paul, he was crazy, but he's crazy smart. That's how he got her to record it. He goes, Donna, you have to hear it. And she's like, I don't want to. He goes, hear it. And so Last Dance was one of her most successful songs. And then I later was in another show with Paul in L.A. called The Rocky Horror Show.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But for now, you're on Broadway in The Me Nobody Knows.
So I was on Broadway with that. Wow. And then in the meantime, a casting director from Hair did not read my bio and said, we want you to play Sheila in Hair. And I was like, oh, I don't know.
He didn't know anything about Chrissy.
Yeah. Oh, but it was funny. They didn't even pay attention to the fact that I'd already done the show. So I went back into it. And so I literally did my last show on a Thursday night of the Me Nobody Knows. And the next night I opened in Hair. And it was like riding a bike, you know. I remembered most of the show.
At some point around this time when you were doing the cast album for the Me Nobody Knows, you met a gentleman named David Lipton.
I did.
You sure did.
Well, there was this hippie that was in the control room, you know, while we were recording. And all of us kept going, who's that guy? Everybody has suits on, and this guy is, like, you know, long hair and dressed very hippie-like and whatever. So during a break, I went over to him, and I said, who are you? You know, and he laughed and said, I'm the publisher of the music. And I was like, oh. So we talked, and here's my card.
Sure, yeah.
And that was the end of that. A week later, I literally bumped into him on Broadway, and under his arm was the test pressing of the cast album. He said, oh, I've got it right here. You want to hear it? I said, of course I want to hear it. So we went up to his office, and, you know, I listened to that. And then he asked me to dinner, and we had dinner and dated and whatever. And I'm still married to him.
Well, you had no idea that that was going to happen.
Not at all.
He is the one that got you to record Don't Say You Don't Remember.
He worked at Metro Media Music, and he was surrounded by fantastic writers. And so he asked a couple of them, hey, do you have anything that might be right for her? And Helen Miller and Estelle Levitt said, yes, we have this song called Don't Say You Don't Remember. So what we did, which is very common back then, we made what they call a master, which means that you make something that's recording top-notch quality,
right,
but you can get the musicians and the studio for demo prices. It's called on spec. So what happens is then you go around to record labels and say, you know, would you like to sign this artist with this record? And so that's what we did, and Scepter loved it and did it, you know, and then you go back and you pay everybody their top price. So that's what we did. He produced it along with Helen Miller, the writer, and there you go.
And Charles Colello arranged it.
Charlie, yeah. He is so talented. I went to his house one day when he was doing some arrangements, and he does it in his head. He doesn't even play the instrument. He just sits there and writes it. And I'm like, what? He told me that his main instrument was accordion, which I thought was pretty funny. He did lots and lots of arrangements.
Don't Say You Don't Remember is the record that made you to a lot of people, an overnight success. Not to the people that had already seen you, which was a multitude of people, but this was your first bona fide hit record, and we're going to listen to it right now.
For you, for me, for all.
If you tell me you don't remember that song, I'm going to just say, you don't remember remembering that song, because you have to remember that song. Everybody knows that song.
It's one of those songs that sometimes you don't remember the title, but then you hear it, and you're like, oh, yeah, I know that song.
You had a bit of controversy with the follow-up single, which was called We're Free, written by L. Russell Brown, sometimes called Larry, and Irwin Levine, who eventually wrote a big hit song called Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree.
They're very successful songwriters, Larry and Irwin. They wrote actually several songs for my album, I'll Make You Music. We're Free was basically about living together without being married. And it was basically about, you know, we're free to come and go as we please. We don't need the piece of paper to show our love. You know, it was right in keeping with the times. And we didn't think that it was controversial at all. That's the way it is, you know. And it had a little bit of country flavor, so it actually was on the country charts as well, mainly because there was a nice little guitar intro. It was kind of country-ish. A lot of the stations, not the country stations, but a lot of the radio stations on the East and West Coast said, oh, we can't play this. No, this isn't right. And we were surprised because it was during that era, you know. But that's what happened. It was a big hit in the South and the Midwest and in Canada. They had no problem with it. But a lot of people on either coast aren't familiar with the song because the stations just never played it.
I have no problem playing it. In fact, I'm going to play it right now. Don't say you don't remember. It got to number 15 on the national Billboard chart, the Hot 100. This one, in spite of the lack of airplay, did creep into the top 40 at number 40.
Yep.
So Casey Kasem played it, and all the
yes.
stations that carried American Top 40. Beverly Bremers and We're Free.
I give myself to you. It's what I want to do. You don't need no vows to hold me. You don't have to wear a sign saying that you're mine. I can feel it when you hold me. No one, you're not really holding me. We can split so we don't split, you see. We're free, you and me.
That was Beverly Bremer's and We're Free, and I'm Ronnie Allen, and we got so much more to discuss because Beverly has recorded so many different things. I'm going to play I'll Make You Music, which is the title cut from that album.
Written by a wonderful, talented guy named Bruce Roberts, who went on to write lots of things with Bernie Taupin when he split with Elton John. He wrote Enough is Enough for Donna Summer.
Written with Paul Jabara, No More Tears, Enough is Enough.
Yes.
It was Donna Summer and Barbara Streisand who had the number one hit with that.
Yes. Bruce is a really talented writer, singer, arranger.
This got to number 63 on the chart, so you were still making the Hot 100.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Long time gone away from me, I knew that you'd return. I've gone through this many times. By now you'd think I'd learn that you'll be coming back again. Come home and turn the key. Then we will dance and we will sing. If only you would come with me. Oh baby, I'll make you music. I'll give you sunshine. Why don't you come along? We'll be together, happy forever, singing our own sweet song. Oh, I'll make you music, lots of fine music, just like we always do. And I know you love me, you really love me, and baby, I love you too. When I'm with you, I can feel a burning heat inside. You can go away from me, but you can.
Talk a little bit about Mousercise.
Well, I started dabbling in songwriting, and I was a closet songwriter for a long time, and then finally my husband encouraged me to play a song at a party, and no one booed, so eventually I started songwriting, and I got some recordings here and there. I had a couple of disco hits that I wrote.
Really?
They were mainly in Europe, but I had a song called Morning Music that was recorded by about three or four different artists. And it was like house hits, because back then in disco, you know, they got played in the discos,
sure,
not necessarily
yeah.
on the air. So I had a couple of those. And I was in the American Song Festival, and one of my songs for that won. I had a song in a movie. It was a song called Once a Night that was kind of a disco-y kind of thing, too. And that was in a Glenda Jackson, Walter Matthau movie. So there were just, you know, different things like that. In the meantime, I was still performing and acting, whatever, in L.A.
Right.
So I went to an audition for a show that actually never happened, but I sang a song that was my own, and the guy who was auditioning was named Mike Post, who, of course, had done tons of, you know, he wrote the Rockford Files and all that. So he came over to me and said, did you write that song? And I said, yes. And he said, I really like it. And he almost had a few artists recorded. It never happened. But I ended up doing commercial jingles with him and stuff like that. But on that day, he said, you should talk to my friend Tom Bocci over at Disney Music. I think he'd like your songs. So I called this guy, and he said, wow, perfect timing. We're looking for this theme song to follow up Disco Mickey Mouse, which had been a huge hit, Disco Mickey Mouse. And they had all well-known writers and artists on it. We have this new one that's an exercise album for kids called Mousercise, and we need a Mousercise song. You think you could write it? And I said, sure. And he needed it right away, and I did three versions that I just banged out on the piano and sang some harmonies to it. And he said, I need it tomorrow morning. I literally ran over to Disney in the middle of the night and left a recording with the guard at the gate. And then he called me the next morning and goes, we love the second one. We want the second one. And I'm like...
Did you write it with somebody?
I did, yeah. I had a good friend who I'd written a musical with, because I've also written quite a few musicals. And I called him and I said, I got to do this like overnight. Come on over, because I don't think I can do this fast by myself. So his name is Dennis Malonis. And so, of course, he was thrilled because he'd never written any songs other than the songs that we had in the musical. So that was fun for him. They recorded it like the next week. You know, the arranger just listened to my little demo that I had banged out.
Right. did you write the words and the music, both of them together with this other guy?
Yeah, that particular one, I'd say I wrote more music, although I did lyrics too. I did both.
The opening line and the one that I saw on YouTube is, come on or something. What's the opening line?
Come on, everybody, and Mousercise, let the music move you till you're carried away.
Hi, Mousercise.
Can watch what you just heard on YouTube. Mousercise Dance Medley, and it features Beverly's song along with some others. I just played an edited version with her song at the beginning and a short portion of it at the end. And if you go to YouTube after listening to the rest of this show, you can mousercise to that dance medley for over 6 minutes.
What was amazing about it was not only was the album a hit, but it became a TV show. It ran on the Disney Channel for 12 years.
And they used that theme every show?
Every day, yes,
so
every show.
More money for you and him.
Yes, I got a gold record and then I got a platinum record.
Oh, my gosh.
Because it went from record to cassette to CD.
Wow.
And so I have one of those at home. My platinum one has all three on there. You know,
congratulations.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah, thank you.
Not bad for something that you just sort of kicked off in a day.
Yeah. Well, I work well under pressure.
Oh,
I always
gee.
Have.
So if somebody said today, Beverly, we need a hit song, would you write it?
Well, I would try. I mean,
today's music, of course, is a little bit different.
Well, nobody knows what is a hit. All you have is your own subjective opinion. Lots of people think they've written hits and they're never hits. And then other songs become hits that nobody expected. So, you know, that's the great mystery of the record business. Always has been, always will be.
You have performed extensively in clubs and concerts in the U.S. and TV commercials. Did you do any national TV commercials?
Yes. I don't think any of my on-camera ones went national other than when I was a teenager. I had some. But my voiceovers, I had a Jazzercise, Thrifty, Shell Oil, Nissan, Honda. Over the years, I've had a bunch. Some were local, some were regional, and then some were national. You know, it's a living.
Over the years, you've been involved in several shows, and now's a good time to mention some of them. The Rocky Horror Show.
The Rocky Horror Show, it was 1974. I had just moved to L.A. I went to see a friend of mine in it. She was understudying one of the roles, and she invited me to see it. We'd been in Hair together. Saw the fabulous Tim Curry in it, and loved the show.
Yeah. Yes.
And then maybe 3 weeks later, this director called me who knew me from New York, and she said, "We need to replace the Janet in the show. Would you like to do it?" And I was like, "What?"
Wow.
I had just seen it, and before I knew it, I was in the show.
Before the movie came out.
They were actually shooting the movie while we were doing it. So Tim Curry left to do the movie, and my friend Paul Jabera replaced Tim. I got to reunite with Paul and do the show. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I had a blast. The audience was nuttier than the cast.
Please tell me about Born a Unicorn.
The very first show I wrote was called Born a Unicorn. This was 1981. There's been some action. We may get another production of it up. It was a show I wrote with Ted Lange from Love Boat. In fact, he was shooting Love Boat when we were doing the show. It's about Ira Aldridge, who was the first black Shakespearean actor of all time and very well known in Europe. And he was from New York, and unfortunately he became ill and never got to do his big comeback in New York. But really fun, informative musical, Born a Unicorn. And I just talked to Ted a couple days ago, and they're doing a festival in Poland, and they're going to be featuring our show. Mm. And Ted and I stayed in touch, you know, for all those years. And then when he got this idea, he was doing a lot of playwriting. That's mainly what he does now. And directing. And, yeah, we came up with the name Unicorn because he wanted to have a drawing of a black unicorn, you know, one of a kind. I wrote this song. I said, "Oh, you were born a unicorn," and we decided that was a good title.
The Glitter Palace.
Yes, that was one of my shows that ran in L.A. It ran for like 9 months, 84 and 85, which was very unusual back then. It was just about this bar and this crazy bag lady who came in and kind of magical. And I hadn't actually planned to be in it, but my co-writer, Dennis, said, "Oh, no, I wrote this part for you." I said, "You did? Oh, okay." It was about a bad stand-up comic.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah, so that's what you think of my jokes.
Oh, man. Could you give me an example of one of your bad jokes?
Oh, I don't remember. Unfortunately, I don't remember. I'd have to look up.
It was so bad you didn't want to remember.
Exactly.
Said, "Please, don't say make me remember this one." Now, this next show was not about me, Rap Master Ronnie. It was about a different Ronnie, and it was done in the late 80s, I believe.
Yeah, for the San Diego Repertory Theater. It was all about Ronald Reagan.
Uh-huh, yes.
It was very funny. It was all based on the comics of Gary Trudeau. In fact, he even would show up once in a while and add things.
Oh, geez.
You know, he handed me something one time. Here's a little girl. I want you to do this sketch about the weapons program or whatever, because it was political. It was a show that was supposed to run for 5 weeks, very Republican town, San Diego, and we weren't even sure how it was going to be received. The opening number is Ronald Reagan rapping with the Secret Service people around him. It's very funny.
And he was very jovial during the show. Yeah, very happy Ronald Reagan.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, it was a runaway hit.
Okay.
So we ran for 9 months.
You were in it all the time for those 9 months?
I was in it the whole time, yeah.
Okay. You did something called Melody Sisters?
Yeah, the Melody Sisters. I didn't write it. I was just in it. I played a mentally disturbed young woman who was in a singing group that they decided to put back together. It was about a 40s, like Andrew Sisters kind of group. they decided to have a comeback, so they took the sister out of the institution, which was me, and we performed. It was great. It was one of the most fun parts I ever had because I did crazy things.
And when were you doing this show?
September of 89.
How about Oh Mary's?
Oh Mary's is a show I wrote, and I even went into it later. We also had a good long run. Most of the shows I've written have had some long runs. This one ran in several theaters at different times and was basically about a gay bar. So there was a little play on words, Oh Mary. Interestingly enough, we made up the name for the lead character. His name was Harry O'Mary. And believe it or not, one night somebody came up to us after the show and said, Hi, here's my card. My name is Harry O'Mary.
Oh,
we couldn't believe it.
As long as As long as he was not going to sue you, you were okay.
No, he loved it. He was waiting all night, I guess,
that. Book, music, and lyrics. And what year are we talking about for that?
89. It took place on New Year's Eve. That particular one ran a couple months, and then it was done again by another theater about a year later.
Now, this one I've heard of, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
William Shakespeare.
This was a very unusual production. Have you heard of the drummer, Max Roach?
Excellent jazz musician.
Well, he wrote it, but I use the term loosely. This show was a jazz improv version of Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
And I don't even think the audience realized what we did. He came up with riffs, like jazz chord progressions, and he would give it to the cast, and then we would do our lines, and we would improvise the melody. And the band would also improvise.
Wow.
It was really quite amazing. So no show was ever the same. And so depending on who you sang with, some of the people sort of locked into certain melodies that they would do. And I was Hermia, and the guy that I was opposite was a jazz singer, and so I never knew what he was going to sing to me, and then of course I had to respond. So it was very challenging and lots of fun, and the director was very avant-garde. He had myself and Helena, we had a fight in a hot tub. Literally, we had a hot tub on the stage, and he did all sorts of crazy things with it. He was not a Shakespearean director, so it had a very jazzy, contemporary feel to it. So it was quite wonderful.
Very avant-garde. So
it was.
Very different.
And one of the stars was Keith David, who had just finished filming Platoon. He was also extremely talented guy.
When did you do A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Well, those were the years that I was in San Diego. It's going to be around 90.
Now we go to Menopause the Musical.
I did that show, I think it was 2004, in L.A. It's playing all over the world in other languages. It's like one of the biggest hits ever. It's a parody musical. It's about these four women who fight over clothing in a department store who are going through menopause.
Uh-huh.
And so they end up sharing their frustrations and their likes and their stories and whatever. But all the music are known songs with different funny lyrics.
Parodies.
And the show's very funny. It's not really just a woman's show because it's about getting old and, you know, all the stuff that you go through. And it's great choreography and funny and fun. People see it zillions of times. I did it for a year. I was in the L.A. cast. It's playing all over. It's still in Las Vegas at the Hilton. Yeah, it's a fun show. If you ever get a chance to see it, it's just light entertainment. It's very fun.
Very good.
But very grueling. It's probably the hardest show I ever did.
So that covers most of what you've done in terms of work outside of your recordings. You released an album about 12 years ago called Don't Say You Don't Remember.
Don't Say You Don't Remember. Beverly Bremers was the actual full title, yes.
Oh.
And that was the one
I
was talking.
That's a great title. Wait a minute. The entire title is Don't Say You Don't Remember Beverly Bremers.
Yes. That's the title.
You could actually add three words to that. Don't Say You Don't Remember Beverly Bremers, pronounced like Dreamers.
There you go. Exactly.
A re-recording of Don't Say You Don't Remember.
And then the rest is original, yes.
Yeah. From that album is this recording called I'm Coming Back.
I'm coming back. Take my place with the winners. I'm coming back. Oh, don't you
doubt it for a minute, I'm coming back. Gonna throw myself right in it, I'm coming back. You got my demise, it was overemphasized. I was only resting for a while, yeah. I was confused, feeling legal and bruised, a contender.
Well, in case you didn't get the title, it was called I'm Coming Back. And what you just heard was a short version of that song. The complete version of that song is on Beverly's CD called Don't Say You Don't Remember, Beverly Bremers. Beverly, I have a few songs here that seem to have some sort of a connection to each other. Namely, They Do Run Run, Tell Him, Downtown, Natural Woman, Nowhere to Run. These are songs that were hits by other people, female vocalists primarily, namely the Crystals, the Exciters, Petula Clark, Aretha Franklin, and Martha and the Vandellas. Although Tell Him was not strictly a girl group. There was one guy in the Exciters, I believe.
Yeah, the Exciters.
Were these songs all done for a specific project?
Yes, I did a CD last year, Remembering the 60s. And I basically wanted to focus on the 60s female singers who influenced me, who I loved, and I sang along with.
Here's a medley of those songs from Remembering the 60s.
I met them on a Monday and my heart stood still. They do run, 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 they do run, run. Somebody told me their name was Bill. They do run, 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 they do run, run.
Forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, and go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure, downtown. Everything's waiting for you. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, but you're the key to my peace of mind. 'Cause you make me feel, you make me feel, you make me feel like a natural woman.
My next question is, what are you doing right now? And besides talking to me, among other things, you are a vocal coach.
I am. In fact, I have somebody coming over in about 20 minutes for voiceover. I teach singing. I teach voiceover. I still do those things and produce voiceover demos for people. I still perform. I have a show tonight, as a matter of fact, with my trio. I have formed a girl trio in addition to my solo act. We're called the Groovelles. We do all the girl stuff from the 60s and 70s. There's Melody Herron and Priscilla Preston. They're both very accomplished performers. in their own right. Priscilla actually does a Patsy Cline show. She's a neighbor of mine who I worked with in the past, and me. We do costume changes, choreography, and, of course, harmonies.
I'd like to close with this one. I understand this song, What I Did for Love, which was from A Chorus Line.
Yes.
You were the first to actually record it. Is that the story with this one?
Yeah, I had just signed with Columbia Records, and they had the cast album for Chorus Line. They said, we want to put out a single of it, and so they invited me to see the show right when it opened, and they said, we want to do it right away, right away.
Uh-huh.
So we ran in the studio and did it, and Charlie Colello wanted to create that signature sound. It sounds in the same genre as Don't Say I Don't Remember. Anyway, we went and did it. I felt that they released it too soon. You know, no one had heard of the show yet, and so it didn't have legs.
Right.
And, you know, to me, that was the biggest problem. Right. They had waited a little while, but they were trying to promote it.
Just want to say I love the recording. Just a pleasure to walk down memory lane with you, and I wish you every bit of health, happiness, and success in the future.
Thank you. And just let me say that if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they can go to my website, which is just my name, beverlybremers.com, and they can click around and see all sorts of things. And my email is there, and I also have a YouTube Beverly Bremers page. People can write comments or whatever, because I love hearing from people. And, of course, I love selling my CDs, and, of course, they're there.
Oh, yeah, very good.
They're on my site, and also CD Baby, and some are on Amazon. You know, I have to put in my little plug.
And I'm glad you did. Closing the show right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Beverly Bremers, with a song from the smash hit musical, A Chorus Line. Music by Marvin Hamlisch, lyrics by Edward Kleban. What I Did for Love.
My eyes are
We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers.